Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the IB Green Minds podcast. My name is Phoebe Scott, and this week I'm joined by George Katsaros. George has over 30 years' experience in both public equities investment advisory and private equity investment. George is the founder of Verditech PLC, a clean tech solar energy company, identifying Verditech's core technologies and leading the company to IPO on AIM. Aside from its core solar business, Verditech has a minority stake in ICSI, Industrial Climate Solutions Inc., a Canadian carbon capture company. More recently, George has co-founded modular construction company Zero Watt Homes, a producer of fast-build, low-cost, energy self-reliant homes. He is also a founding partner of Farm Street Partners Investment Management and a co-founder of the 8 Great Technologies UK Venture Capital Advisory Panel, set up under ex-Cabinet Minister for UK Science and Universities, the Right Honourable Lord David Willetts. George, thank you so much for joining me this week on the Green Minds podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Phoebe. Thank you.
So I thought it would be helpful to start off by talking about the clean tech landscape. And how do you think this has evolved since you started your professional career over 30 years ago?
Well, over the last 30 years, there has been a lot of talk on climate change, and it's been very contentious and a big debate. And 2-3 decades ago, the activists were regarded as extremist lobbyists. And I think progressively over the last 30 years, opinions have shifted towards the more activist approach, and there's been increasing evidence concerning data on CO2 emissions. There's been natural disasters, which are finally making us all, governments alike, sit up and question the sort of legacy that we're going to be leaving our children and their descendants. So I think there's a big change. When I left the structured world of employment in investment banking, one of the first things I did when I left was to go to a clean tech conference in San Francisco in 2009. And I remember this incredible buzz, that it was so palpable that everyone there felt this new sea change was underfoot, embracing new technologies. It was one of the biggest conferences in clean tech that had ever taken place. And even then, you had, you know, many, many new technology companies presenting their smart cities, emission reductions on engines, you know, new ways to capture CO2. And it was very exciting. But alas, I think for the ensuing decade, it was a decade too early. Many of the aspirational startups and aspirational entrepreneurs suffered from a lack of funding. There was a recession coinciding with it. Many of the major industrial and commercial groups invested in the what I would call the first generation technologies in carbon capture, and a lot of money was lost in the first generations, and this gave the clean energy and clean tech space a bad reputation. It was almost a dirty word and a euphemism for being a category to lose money fast in. So clean tech and clean energy has had to really sort of evolve the hard way after that difficult first decade. And a number of industries wrongly relied on public subsidies. The solar industry is a case in point. Many companies were bankrupted. There was an excessive supply created on the back of these subsidies, and there was a fast race to the bottom in terms of pricing. So, you know, another example is the solar industry, therefore, of embracing clean energy solutions with the wrong business model. But right now, I think there is a major sea change underway. New technologies breaking through, AI and synthetic biology sectors, good examples of new industrial revolutions that are underway. Synthetic biology is a classic example of being able to replace the carbon economy with a new biofuel economy. So you have a lot of breakthrough technological solutions which are coming through now, which can stand on their own 2 feet commercially without the use of subsidies. And so I would say that the old economy stocks are having a major existentialist threat right now, unprecedented proportions. So, you know, the banking sector, electric utilities, construction, telcos, these are all classic examples of being littered with major groups that do not have sustainable new products and quite often represent value traps for investors. They're just sort of clinging to their investors by paying high dividends to keep them from leaving. So I think there is a major shift underway. And I think the clean energy space, the clean tech space, for once now represents an irreversible wave. So I think it's extremely positive. There's enough evidence, I think, for example, you've got the UK government's 10-point plan involving wind, hydrogen, CO2 capture, sustainable housing, all being heavily invested in by the public sector.
As you mentioned, the first renaissance in the late noughties was potentially a case of right tech and ideas, but wrong timing. And now, as you just mentioned, we've seen an insurgence of, for example, synthetic biology, which is very interesting. Just touching upon your personal career path, as you yourself have worked in both more traditional finance roles and other roles more recently at the intersection of finance, science and technology, how would you say that your expertise of one area has helped in your understanding of the others and vice versa?
I think it's been very helpful. The sort of training you get in finance is an important framework that you can work with. When a technology company is presented to me, an early stage technology company, it's a very sort of unstructured environment. You've got potentially an unproven technology, which is being heralded as a breakthrough disruptive technology. It's going into new markets, it's new product. It's very hard to make a judgment call without having to resort to some kind of framework that you have to build around your assumptions. So you have to follow a structured approach to start with, at least what is the company going to be doing, making, producing, what sort of customer base does it have, how big is that target addressable market, how quickly can it penetrate that market, what is the capital required to penetrate that market, is it an asset light model, is it capital intensive, is there a better approach to commercializing that company's product via licensing. So you can build up a series of questions that you hope to be able to answer in order to build a picture on that company. But it can only go so far. And one of the most important other pillars that you will need to support a business is the people factor. You can have a great scientist that does the technical due diligence on a company. You can use your own financial expertise to build the model on that company, to evaluate whether the investment requirement is the right one, whether the upside is big enough of the addressable market. But when you come to the people factor, there is no training. There's only experience of judging people's characters. And it's an incredibly important aspect because it's the second pillar, along with the technology, to a company's success or failure. It's critical. And it's very hard to judge people out of context sometimes when they're not in difficult situations. And you quite often learn that people are very different years down the road when they're faced with a different set of circumstances. So that's something which your financial experience doesn't prepare you for ever.
Now just touching upon Verditech, which you co-founded, for our listeners who may not have heard of Verditech, could you please explain what the company does?
Verditech was IPO'd with three businesses in. It's an ultra-lightweight solar module manufacturer, and it's got an associate company, which is a carbon capture company called ICSI, and there's a third technology, deodorization.
As you mentioned, one of the key selling points of Verditech's solar business are the solar panels' lightweightness and flexibility. Relating to this unique functionality, what would you say are Verditech's main target markets?
Because we're one-tenth of the weight of conventional solar panels with no glass, we are targeting areas principally where conventional panels just don't work. We have a number of new industry verticals which are very exciting, which are just opening up. One of the big growth opportunities is replacing diesel wet fuel with dry fuel with solar. So in the mining industry, you know, the mining industry is a very dirty industry, but their environmental agencies and regulators are forcing them to embrace green energy where possible. And because mines are typically located off grid or miles away from grids, there's a huge opportunity for us to supply 40-foot containers which can unravel a mobile generation solar plant. Just literally out of a 40-foot container, we can supply 250 kilowatts of power. So four containers, you know, 1 megawatt. I think there are about 4,000 mines in the world that could take 1 to 2 megawatts. So that's a big market for us. Marine, we can be kitted out on the deck of yachts. We're actually successfully selling into the marine industry. Refrigerated trucks, a huge industry. The payback on replacing the guzzling diesel gensets is 1 year. Mining, by the way, can be, depending on the tax regime in Australia, you could be at the moment as low as 17 months payback on a 10-year product. So it's very, very attractive. Mobile base stations, wind turbines, we can actually be put on the poles of wind turbines to provide ancillary power. And obviously residential buildings, commercial buildings, which we're breaking into. We can be velcroed onto a military tent. So we can actually go on aircraft, hangar, tents and field hospitals in the theatre of battle. We can colour our solar modules, different colours, camouflage, desert Pantone, any colour. It's a very versatile product.
That sounds very interesting and attractive and differentiating market for Verdatech, which I'm sure sets you apart from rival solar panel companies. How do you anticipate that the solar PV market will develop over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, Phoebe, I think one thing we can say is there'll be exponential growth, but there are two different, I would say, drivers. You know, you've got the main market, which is the I've referred to as the traditional glass commoditized panels market, which is over 500 billion. That's already had its major growth spurt. We operate in a niche, if you like. I say niche inverted commas because it's 22 billion currently. We think there'll be exponential growth in this sub-segment to 28 billion in just the next 2 to 3 years. We are in a very small classroom. We've got about 2 or 3 major competitors at the moment, Sunman, Earch, and DAS. We're not complacent. There's an enormous amount of aspirational claims out there. So some of the old materials that are coming back, that they were breakthroughs several years ago in, for example, perovskite, but that had a high degree of degradation and so the product wasn't viable. Now, universities like Sydney are claiming there that they've cured the problem of degradation. So there's always something to worry about in terms of the next few years of competitive pressures. But we ourselves are working on the next generation solar cells that we are trying to develop in terms of using graphene. We have a very exciting joint development program with a great company in Cambridge called Paragraph. We believe they are the only company that can synthetically mass produce graphene with over 95% uniformity. So it's very important, this development, because 10 years ago, graphene was discovered by the Nobel Prize winners in Manchester, and it really hasn't been able to fulfill the promise that this commodity, which was dubbed the miracle substance, because it's 1,000 times more conductive than silicon. It's durable, it's flexible, but no one could mass produce it with the uniformity that our Cambridge partners can produce it with. So this is very exciting for us. We've already developed the first graphene integrated photovoltaic cell, and we hope that we can finish our development program and get it to commercialization. There will be new applications that we would aim to be on. Because of the uniformity of the graphene, we will be able to hopefully put it on the back of consumer electronics devices like laptops and smartphones, because one atomic layer is about a millionth of the width of your hair. We only need about 5 to produce a photovoltaic cell that would be as strong as the stainless steel on your smartphone, and it could be on the back and you wouldn't need to plug in your phone. You could trickle charge your phone just by sitting in Starbucks or something with enough daylight to trickle charge it. So there are some exciting developments that we're working on for the next generation, but I think the sector is a major growth sector still.
Just going back to Verdatech itself, you IPO'd Verdatech on the AIM market in 2017. Regarding Verdatech's investor base, have you noticed increasing interest from ESG-focused investors? Or would you say that you touched upon the mainstreaming of solar energy? Does this mean that you attract a broader base of investors?
Well, I think you're right to mention ESG. ESG is becoming, you know, I talked about the irreversible wave of clean tech. I think what is also irreversible and is fast becoming mainstream is ESG and ESG-focused investors. And in fact, we had a research note just written on us recently where we were asked to fill in our ESG section on the note. And it's going to become such an important benchmark in terms of accounting. The biggest asset managers in the world, like BlackRock, are making it an essential prerequisite for companies to pass a certain level of a point system sort of awards that they give companies to be able to be investable in. So companies that don't make the change to, you know, having proper environmentally sustainable product and diversity on the board, corporate governance is essential. There'll be a huge disparity in valuations of companies that do not embrace ESG. I think in terms of solar, I think there's been a mainstreaming of interest now, right down to the man on the street. So I said to you before that a number of industries are embracing solar, which haven't before. So you've got this extraordinary full circle movement of the dirty industries meeting the, you know, the clean, you know, the mining industry now switching diesel to solar. In terms of the mainstream interest, I think people on the street are hugely interested. You know, they're paying too high bills. People are very, very upset with the expensive bills they've been paying. They want to be seen to be socially responsible. They want to be environmentally friendly. And we offer an aesthetic solution for these people. We offer lightweight panels that can be slate colored and visually blend in better than conventional heavy glass panels. And they're 1/6 to 1/10 of the weight, so they're easier to install. So we think we've got a product which should break into the mainstream. And we've got many of our shareholders are asking us, you know, can I stick it on my house first? Can I be one of the first customers on this new product? So I think it's a very exciting shift, and I think we are becoming a mainstream product.
Fascinating that you mentioned the public interest as well. I think I'm becoming convinced.
Well, it's inevitable, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's great that more and more members of the public are wanting to put these on their houses and make their homes more environmentally friendly. And that actually feeds in very nicely to our next topic, which is your other venture, which you co-founded, Zero Watt Homes. Zero Watt Homes claims that it addresses the issue of a global lack of sustainable, affordable housing, which is obviously a key issue globally at the moment. And how do you intend to counter this with Zero Watt Homes?
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that one of the oldest known activities to man is house building since we emerged from caves. I mean, we've been building houses for centuries. It is extraordinary that we are faced in such an affluent world that, compared to the world that our predecessors lived in, that we have a problem of not being able to build houses fast enough. With all the technology that has evolved, it's something to be ashamed of in a way, really, that McKinsey, I think, in a recent report said that there are 300 million families that need to be housed. Just look at our own statistics in the UK. You can see the problems that we're wrestling with. I think the government needs to build between three, according to the Parliament paper 2018, I think it needs to build 300,000 to 400,000 social homes a year. And there's been a complacency amongst the traditional builders to evolve. So some of the traditional builders are using sort of medieval techniques of, you know, bricklaying. And it's extraordinary that some of the incumbents haven't been, I don't want to call it arrogance, but they haven't been very fast at developing new methods of construction. It should come as no surprise to anyone that there are new entrant aspirant category killers like ourselves that want to come in and build ultra low cost, much faster to erect housing. And that's what we're doing. I mean, some of the traditional build costs are just too high. You know, if it costs sort of £150 to £300 a square foot to build a house with bricks and mortar, and it takes them 9 months to complete, the government is never going to be able to meet the targets that I referred to earlier, the required targets. So there has to be a change, and there has to be a new method to construction. As far as we're concerned, we're coming at it from a completely different perspective to traditional builders. We're sort of akin to the automotive industry. We're targeting four product segments: luxury, social homes, emerging market, ultra-low cost homes, and mining and construction semi-permanent accommodation. So four product segments, and we're devising a steel-framed homogeneous structure like a single chassis. Like in the automotive industry, you have a single chassis that fits all those product segments, and we can wrap different skins, design skins, around that one-size-fits-all homogeneous steel-framed structure. We can be much lower cost, so we're targeting for social homes, for example, in the UK, about £100 to £120 a square foot. We are aiming to have 4 or 5 people to be able to erect these houses in under 2 weeks. The homes will be energy self-reliant, so we can build off-grid housing. In the UK, everything has to be connected to the grid, but we can be off-grid. Our emerging market product is earthquake-proof to a Richter scale of 7.2. hurricane proof to winds of 200 kilometers an hour. And so our construction methods are sort of hybrid. So we call ourselves, we have a USP, a unique construction method, which we call podular, where it's sort of hybrid between volumetrics for the bathrooms and the kitchens, but we build up from the center of the core of the building, and we're not volumetric completely. We don't build all the houses principally in the factory. So we're very much an assembly and packaging and logistics asset light model.
Given this systemic need for cost-effective and green housing, you touched upon your work in the UK market. What role would you argue that the UK government, or potentially other governments as well, should play in aiding innovation alongside the private sector?
I think that more money should be invested in the early stage technology arena. I think that $2.5 billion for venture in the next 5 years is a welcome investment by the British government. But I think it's a drop in the ocean when taken in context with the sort of US equivalent Silicon Valley raises that are going on now, where Series A raises $100 million. I think there needs to be much, much greater investment in early stage innovation. And I don't really know if the government has grasped that this is not a high-risk venture proposition for them. If you invest in early-stage technology, some of these companies that I'm looking at, 3 years after having seed rounds, are actually creating manufacturing jobs and opening factories. So if you fail to invest enough money in your own early-stage technologies, you are actually effectively saying goodbye to manufacturing jobs that you could be creating.
You have touched on this briefly before, but I just wanted to go back onto specific geographical areas of focus for Zero Rot Homes. You mentioned the UK and emerging markets. Could you elaborate any more on this?
One of the reasons why we are geographically targeting certain areas are just simply because of the nexus we have and the strengths that we're playing to. So part of the team is in Australia. Australia has major requirements like the rest of the world for there's a shortage of affordable housing. And so apart from the UK and Ireland, where we're going to be focusing, we have a major pipeline in Australia, especially after the recent bushfires. There's been an acceleration of planning and the requirement to build has increased dramatically. And so we have a pipeline of about just over 700 homes in New South Wales. We're also targeting the Caribbean after some of the devastation over the recent years. There's still a very big need to build. We think we've got the right product to go into the emerging market, low cost African subsegment. So we have a pipeline there. We weren't planning this until recently. We managed to secure a very good opportunity with Bertoni in Italy. We weren't going to be developing the luxury end, but now we have the expertise with a 50-50 joint venture, which is very, very exciting with Bertoni to develop the luxury end. Bertoni has a history of developing the interiors of Lamborghini, Ferrari, and has also developed some beautiful luxury homes in the Turks and Caicos. So we're very excited, and we will be developing a luxury premium villa product as well.
It would be great just to touch upon now your association with ICSI, the Industrial Climate Solutions Inc., which is a carbon capture and storage company. Obviously, they employ this carbon capture and storage technology, but I was very interested to hear your thoughts on geoengineering overall as a method of mitigating climate change.
Yes, this technology has very, very great promise. And I was a co-founder in the original company called WES. This is a liquid gas absorption technology, which is unique. It uses a heterogeneous bubble nucleation process, which simply put is millions and millions of bubbles inside a chamber that the solvent comes into an absorber into the chamber and captures the CO2. Without using what conventional absorber towers have. Normally, the conventional process is to fill the chamber with very expensive stainless steel conventional packing, which is extremely expensive and very inefficient and clogs up, and you can't use precipitating solvents with that packing. And so the technology is an enabler. It allows the latest solvents to be used, principally the precipitating solvents that are more efficient and reduce the parasitic load in carbon capture, because one of the main problems of carbon capture, which is why it hasn't been commercially viable, is that you have to heat the solvent. You have to reheat it to a very high temperature in order to regenerate the solvent and use it again. And that meant that the carbon capture cost is very, very high. If you can use a precipitating solvent without it clogging, you can collapse the cost of CO2 capture. That's why this technology is very, very important. But the main issue with this technology is a similar issue to all of the carbon capture technologies, and that is that you need a solution. And no single technology provides a holistic solution for CO2 capture. And that's why I think you haven't seen any global multi-billion company emerge in the CO2 capture arena. And what you're going to have to see, and I think it's very close now, is a combination of technologies. So, for example, ICSI's technology, which is almost like a microchip, enables a computer to be used. It's an enabler, but on its own, a microchip is useless. You need a computer. So to use that analogy, you know, this capture technology needs to be used with other technologies in order to provide a solution. And geological sequestration is problematic. So when you've captured the CO2, what do you do with it? Governments are talking about geological sequestration again. But we all know that Longannet in the UK and Scotland was closed down. White Rose, the government project there, was closed down because they were not commercially viable. It's too expensive. And so what you really need is you need a series of technologies combining at a cost-effective price to basically capture the CO2 and reuse it. And we have examples where one potential combination could be ICSI combining with a Californian company called Blue Planet, which is green cement. So taking the CO2 and reusing it in aggregates in cement. There is an example of the potential holy grail where you're combining technologies in an environmentally effective way. And if it's cost effective, then I think that will be a game changer.
Thank you. That's fascinating. Definitely an exciting space to keep an eye on. I just wanted to conclude the episode by asking if you had any suggestions for any of our listeners today who potentially might be interested in a career in clean technology, and if you had any suggestions for steps that they might take.
I think I would just say that clean tech space probably right now, you know, I talked about the 2009 period post clean tech San Francisco being a difficult decade. I think right now, 10 years on, this is probably the single biggest wave of positive growth to be in. I think this is a huge secular growth trend. I cannot specify where you should go, whether it's energy storage, efficiency, what type of energy, wind, solar, battery tech. There's so many different sub-elements and sub-sectors that are attractive where, you know, it's a bubbling cauldron of change. Taking a high risk when you're young and getting into early stage companies is a good thing, even if some of them are not successful, even if, you know, they don't pay the same wages that you might get on a multinational platform in a graduate training scheme. I think taking risk and getting experience and being given more responsibility in smaller companies is probably what I would do. So I hope that's worth something in terms of advice.
That was really helpful. As you mentioned, it's a playoff between risk and reward, and potentially starting off your career in clean tech might be more risky, but then higher rewards down the line. So I'm sure our listeners will take that as food for thought. And finally, if listeners could take away one thing from this episode of the IB Green Minds podcast, what would you want it to be?
I hope people get the realization that this green wave of clean tech is irreversible. It's probably the biggest growth opportunity and wave for the next 20, 30 years. I think it's bigger than the Big Bang, the hedge fund bonanza, the internet, and it's more sustainable. This is not a fad. And I think young people looking to decide on their careers should really look no further than getting into clean energy, clean tech applications. Because I think the old economy and some of these old economy sectors, they're not offering the sustainable growth necessarily that young people deserve. And I think that governments should be investing in apprenticeships, which should have the same status as universities, to enable young people to reskill and to enter some of the new industries and new areas.
Thank you so much, George, for all of your insights today and for coming on the
podcast. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.